This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Azim's Bardo, From Murder to Forgiveness, A Father's Journey. And the author is Azim Kamissa. And Azim joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Azim.
Hello, Steve.
So great to have you with us. This is it's going to kind of rip your heart out when you hear what you've gone through. But at the same time, it's a story with a victory exclamation point because of all that you've learned and all that you're doing to teach forgiveness and to teach peace. Let me read what you've written just to set the stage. You say this: we all encounter defining moments in our life. Mine was the murder of my son. At these points, if you are able to make the right choice, you literally manifest a miracle. This book is about how to make that right choice. So we go back to the year 1995, Azim, January 21st. Tell us about what at that point in time, what was your profession and what happened?
I worked as an international investment banker, and I speak a half a dozen languages, travel the world, and my world came to a crashing halt. My son, who was 20 years old, he was an art student at San Diego State University, and on Fridays and Saturdays, he worked as a pizza delivery man, and it was his turn to make a delivery. He worked for a local Italian restaurant not far from where he went to school, and he was lured to a bogus address where the restaurant routinely delivered, and it was an apartment building. He went and knocked on several doors to see who'd ordered the pizzas, and nobody had. So he came back to his car, and he put the pizzas in the trunk of his car, and he climbed into the driver's side seat, and as he was about to leave the scene of the crime, he was accosted by four youth gang members. Three of them were 14-year-old, and the leader of the gang was an 18-year-old. Who handed a 9mm handgun to a 14-year-old, and as my son is preparing to back, you know, his car from the driveway of the apartment building, the 18-year-old gave the order, "Bust him bones," and he fired one round, which entered my son's body under the left shoulder blade. It traveled through the upper part of his chest, and the bullet actually exited from the right armpit. But it was fatal, and he died drowning in his own blood a couple of minutes later over a lousy pizza at the age of 20. So needless to say, you know, it brought my life to a crashing halt, and right. As you could imagine, as a parent, I went through all the emotions, you know, overwhelming grief, despair. At one point, I was suicidal. Did not know how to live without my son. I have a beautiful daughter, but he was my only son. And a great kid. I mean, great sense of humor, handsome, charismatic, lots of friends, a great writer, a good photographer, and had a lot going for himself.
So this moment in time is beyond our comprehension, obviously, as listening to you talk about it. At that moment in time when your world came crashing down, you didn't want to even live anymore, how did you turn this tragedy into victory? What was the impetus, the motivation, the stimulus? What happened?
What happened is that I had my first out-of-body experience when I found out that Arik had been shot and killed. And the pain was so excruciating, as you would imagine, that I actually left my body. And I believe in God, and I went into the loving arms of God. He held me in an embrace for a long time. And after the explosion subsided, he sent me to my body with the wisdom that there are victims at both ends of the gun. And that kind of started my journey. And I, at that time, I did not know where that came from. I know it did not come from my intellect. I know it did not come from my heart. It came from a higher power. And today I look back and say that what saw me through this process of getting through Tariq's tragic death was not my degrees in math and finance, although I went to some pretty good schools in England. It was as a result of a strong spiritual foundation. Because it's easy to see that my son is a victim of the 14-year-old gang member. It is harder to see that he is also a victim of society. And that started my journey, and I got looking and thinking, you know, why do kids join gangs? And the more I learned about it, and the answers I got absolutely horrified me. They join gangs to get respect because a lot of the kids, peers or gang members respect them or often dress like them. Or they join for protection because, you know, they live in areas where they don't join gang A, you know, the gang, they're targeted by gang B. We have a lot of Hispanics that live in San Diego, so we have a lot of racial gangs, Hispanic gangs, African-American gang, Asian gangs, white gangs. Or they join gangs because they don't have a sense of belonging in their own homes. And now that I've done this work for 17 years and met many, many gang members, I'm shocked to meet gang members that are three or four generations from gang members. And I didn't think we were doing enough about it because I felt that these kids sometimes are forced, you know, into these situations, and that as a society we have failed them. And I think it took this level of empathy to say that there's something we can do about it because violence is a learned behavior. Nonviolence can also be a learned behavior. So that particular vision of seeing victims at both ends of the gun helped me then reach out and start a foundation named after my son. And I started with $8,000 in my home office. It's called the Tariq Kamisa Foundation. And I reached out to the grandfather and guardian of my son's killer and told him that, you know, I'm not here screaming retribution and revenge. Rather, I'm here in the spirit of compassion and forgiveness because what I see here is we both lost a son. My son passed away and you lost your grandson. It was like a son to him because Tony calls him daddy to the criminal justice system. And I started this foundation and our mandate is to stop kids from killing kids by breaking the cycle of youth violence. And, you know, we essentially have three mandates. First and foremost, to save lives of children. Second, to teach the principles of, you know, empower the right choices so kids don't make the bad choices. And then to teach the principles of nonviolence, of empathy, of compassion, of forgiveness. And fast forward 17 years, and the grandfather and I are still together. The foundation has been hugely successful. I speak on this work internationally, and we now have over 42 employees at the foundation, and we are successfully teaching these principles. So it was the right choice for me, and I made the choice to forgive and then reach out to the grandfather. And then 5 years later, I also went to meet the young man who killed my son, so he was 19 years old. And this particular book has now been updated because I wrote the book 3 years after Tariq passed away. But a lot has happened since then, including my relationship with the kid who killed my son. So now your readers will be able to also look at that piece of my journey.
Well, there are a lot of victims in society. There's a lot of anger out there. There's everything from racism to actual physical abuse, sexual abuse, the crimes against in the name of some kind of needing to buy food for the family today, the way it's getting. So how does a person learn to forgive?
I think that, first of all, I think forgiveness is not really well understood in our culture. Forgiveness is something you do for yourself. Now, there is this connotation that by me forgiving Tony, who murdered my son, I'm somewhat condoning his behavior. It's not about him. He has his own journey, and he's serving a far longer sentence than I would like. In fact, I'm trying to get him out early. He's 30 years old today, and he's shifted as a result of my forgiveness. But I think, the coming back to your question, that I recognize two things. That if I stayed in resentment, who am I hurting? I'm hurting me. There's a great quote that Mandela made famous. It says, resentment is like drinking poison and waiting for your enemy to die. So if you stay in anger or if you stay in resentment, eventually that becomes a disease. I mean, it's like self-abuse. You might as well take a whip and beat yourself. The second thing that I recognized is that if I didn't forgive, I would stay a victim. And there is no quality of life being a victim. I didn't want to go through life on crutches saying, I lost my one and only son. I know people do feel sorry for me, but I had a very full life when my son was alive. I wanted that full life back. And unless you forgive, you remain a victim. I do have a very full life today. I've written 4 books, and I speak worldwide. And the work I do today, I like better, because investment banking was all about making money. This is about saving lives of children. And I would not be doing any of this had I not lost my son. So I think if you get the concept that forgiveness is it's a selfish act. You do something for yourself. It's a healthy selfish act. And there wasn't much on forgiveness when I wrote my book. In the last 10 years, there's been a lot more research that is validating the healthy benefits of forgiveness. And I think the first thing you need to do is to learn that forgiveness is something that you do for yourself. Tony has his own journey. Even if he wasn't caught and not serving a sentence, he still has to live the rest of his life with a conscience that he killed an unarmed, innocent human being. And there is no escaping wrongdoing. I leave that to the higher power. I think that if you look and see that I have a journey forward, which is separate from Tony, and how am I going to live the rest of my life? Once you get to that awareness, then I teach the steps of how to forgive. And I think that the steps are in the book. There is a chapter on forgiveness. The book is on murder to forgiveness. The first chapter is murder. The last is forgiveness. And the steps are that, A, you know, you have to acknowledge that you have been wrong, and it's a grieving process. And it's a painful process. I make this very clear to people that go through my forgiveness training, that, you know, that we don't grieve enough. And grieving in itself is medicine. And the cure for pain is in the pain. This is a quote from Rumi, that, you know, our particular culture, it does not like pain. You know, I mean, the slightest headache and you reach out for an extra strength Tylenol. Or if you are depressed, you go get a prescription on Prozac. The problem with that is 5 hours later, you take another pill. So I tell people that pain is unavoidable, because through pain, the universe molds you to the person that I have become. So pain is unavoidable. Suffering is avoidable. That through pain, you can mold yourself into a different kind of a person. There's a beautiful story out of a book called The Prophet by Khalil Gibran, where he talks about this artist who's working with clay, and he loves his masterpiece so much that he actually wets the masterpiece, the clay, with his tears. But then he's going to take this masterpiece and put it in a 2400-degree Fahrenheit oven so the clay can become porcelain and radiate its beauty. So I think the first step of how you forgive is you go through this grieving process, and the book will guide you through it. The second piece is to give up all the resulting resentment. And we talked about how resentment can be very corrosive. And the way you do this is by developing a high level of empathy and also creating a very sincere intention. On my website, there is a guided meditation on forgiveness. I used to meditate an hour a day. Now my practice is 2 hours a day. There's a free download on that, and a free download of the guided meditation on forgiveness, where you set the intention and you set it in a meditative state at alpha. And once you are able to set that intention to the universe. That's the preparation piece. And I always say forgiveness is when preparation meets grace. And the book will show how do you prepare for it. And once you set the empathy and intention, just like I was blessed by grace with the gift of forgiveness, so will the readers be. And the third piece is to reach out. Is to reach out to the offender. Not only reach out, but to reach out with love and compassion. Not every one of us has to reach out to the murderer of our child. Very often, you know, the issue is husband-wife or ex-husband, ex-wife. The issue is father-son, mother-daughter, you know, peers at work. There's a lot of conflict wherever there's people. I actually do this work in corporations, too, with management teams, and teach that through the process of forgiveness and redemption, we can create unity. So the idea is that you take these three steps, and the book will guide you as to how you take these steps. And there's also a lot more material available on my website.
Azim, we can't even begin to just barely skim the surface of your book. That's why it's so important for people to read this, to get their own copy, share it with family, friends, neighbors. It's just one of those books that is a pearl to help those who struggle and to help all of us to learn how to help others to forgive as well. So thank you so much, Azim, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing. Tell us how to get your book.
We can go to balboapress.com or you can buy it anywhere. And it's also available on my website, which is my name, azimkhamisa.com. And that's A-Z-I-M as in Mary, K-H-A-M as in Mary, I-S as in sugar, A.com. So it's widely available. So there should be no, and it's available in hardcover, it's available in softcover, it's also available as an e-book. And Balboa Press also is carrying it on their website.
Thanks again for being with us, Azim.
You're welcome, Steve, and I appreciate the interview.
This interview has been brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Get ready to live La Bella Vita with Dawn Catherine on Toginet.com. Live La Bella Vita. If you're wanting to know all the beauty tricks of the trade and the latest fashion trends before everyone else, this is your show. If you admire celebrities' beauty and their fashion sense, this is your show. Do you love wine and want to know more about the process it takes to make wine from the vine to the bottle? This is your show. Live La Bella Vita. For more on the show and your host, check out her website, labellavitacosmetico.com. This is the kind of show you can sink your teeth into. If you enjoy traveling and food and family, all with an Italian flair, then you can live La Bella Vita with your host, Dawn Catherine. Wednesday nights at midnight, 11 p.m. Central on toginet.com. Mark Lipinski is coming to TogiNet. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski. A live two-hour show Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on TogiNet.com. Creative Mojo. It's fun, entertaining, informative, inspirational, and illuminating. Lipinski has worked on such shows as Oprah, The View, The Joan Rivers Show, and Ricky Lake. He's busy, but he's got the drive to share with Creative Mojo, dedicated to the modern crafter and crafting lifestyle. Dive into the info and enjoy everything from celebs to entertainment news to recipes, quilting and needlework, knitting, painting, woodworking, Christmas crafts, and so much more. This show boldly encourages you to discover and harness your own creative spirit by living creatively every day. For more on Mark and the show, check out marklipinski.com. Don't miss the fun. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Four Livers, and no funeral, living with a deadly disease and beating the odds. And the author is Gloria Edel, and Gloria joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Gloria.
Hello.
Well, so good to have you with us. What a fighter you are. You've beaten all the odds, haven't you?
I think so. A lot of them, at least. Quite a bit.
Well,
quite a few.
Well, we're talking about 3 liver transplants, 1 kidney transplant, 2 hip replacements, and now you've had your 3rd knee replacement, and of course plenty more life-threatening health issues on 2 different continents, and even set in the film industry. My goodness, this book is riveting, full of twists, similar to a novel. You can't make this stuff up.
That's true.
That's more than you could ever imagine in fiction, but this is real. This is reality. Gloria, when did it all start? How, you know, when did it start? When did you first have your first problem?
Well, I was 12 years old, and I was taking out the trash, and I had a fainting spell. They say it was an epileptic spell, but apparently it was not, because epilepsy is something that you have your whole life, and this was just a fainting spell with epileptic tendencies. In other words, I had the inability to control my movement, and therefore I fell and just became unconscious. But in the end, it wasn't epilepsy, but that was the first sign that something was off with my health.
And so at that time, you got your first replacement?
No, at that time, my mother and I, we were living in Germany at the time. So my mother and I ran to doctors. We tried to get a proper diagnosis. I know this now, but at the time, they kept giving us different diagnoses that were actually wrong, because I had so many different symptoms, including nosebleeds and other episodes of these quote-unquote epileptic episodes. And in the end, they really couldn't figure out what was going on with me. Having said that, no doctor had taken a blood test, because a blood test would have revealed that something was wrong with my liver. So it took me from 12 to 18 when I finally basically became extremely ill, and was admitted to the hospital to find out that my liver was in very bad shape.
And I guess that's why you point out so strongly that doctors, we have to remember, they're human and they make mistakes.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, if you're happy with your doctor, I say that's wonderful. But I think it's important that as patients, and for me definitely as a veteran patient, to also be on your guard. You have to think along with the doctor and not leave it just up to him. Yes, he's studied and he knows better, but there are cases where your instincts, or basically your feeling, will tell you that something is off. And I think it's important also to listen to that. And I have an example actually in the book when I was pregnant, and I was told to abort my second child. There were good reasons for this. My uterus had basically torn to shreds, and 6 doctors sat between my legs and sewed my uterus together after I had my first child. And then I was pregnant with my second child 3 months later. And the doctor basically sent me to an expert and said, no, 50% chance that your uterus will explode. You cannot carry this child. And I chose to ignore that advice. Because, you know, in pregnancy, you will feel it. Your body will abort. Your body will not accept something that is substandard when it comes to pregnancy. As we often know, women will abort and they don't understand why. Well, most likely there's a situation going on that is beyond their understanding, but it's there. So I chose to let my pregnancy carry on, although the doctor was very clear that there was great danger to doing this. And I must say, my second child was born bigger than the first. My first child was 3 pounds, 2 ounces. My second child was 4 pounds, 2 ounces. So I think I was right in that moment, at that time when I decided to go on with the pregnancy and go against my husband at the time, my first husband's wishes, the doctor's wishes, my friends were telling me not to. But somehow I felt it was right, and I'm happy I did because I have two wonderful sons. Actually, while I say this, I am also the first woman in the world to have two children after liver transplantation. So, yeah.
Exactly. Now, what was the next challenge? When did that come?
So I was in the hospital with a case of what they thought at the time was hepatitis C. It turned out later that it probably wasn't. It was probably autoimmune disease. But at the time, this wasn't a known diagnosis, and therefore they diagnosed it as hepatitis C, which is the equivalent to non-A, non-B. In other words, C was pretty much an open book. No one knew what it was. And that's when you didn't know what the liver was sick with, you called it hepatitis C. So I was 3 months in the hospital, and basically they couldn't heal me. They couldn't cure me. I took very high dosages of prednisone, and still I remained sick. But still being sick, one thing I always did, and I'm a big advocate of this, and this is exercise. No matter how sick I was, and this is I want to say leitmotif, but I guess that's not an English word. I want to say it's a subject throughout the book, exercise. I always, 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 in the worst times, exercise came to my rescue to you know, get your body going. It was always important, no matter how sick I was. So the next challenge basically came as my liver deteriorated and I kept going from hospital to hospital. Eventually, I came to the States because they couldn't do anything more for me in Germany, and I was in the hospital, and a doctor said, have you ever thought of a liver transplant? And at the time, this is 1983, this was really not a very, very known procedure at all. So I hadn't heard of it, and he said, well, I'll get you in touch with the doctor. And I'm very thankful to him. Unfortunately, I don't even remember that doctor's name because I only met him that one time. But he did put me in touch with Pittsburgh at the time, which was the only transplant center in the world. And he put me in touch with the doctors there. And I flew back to Germany just to get my affairs in order, so to speak. And then I flew to Pittsburgh, and I stayed there until they called me. At first, they evaluated me. At the time, it was at Falk Clinic. I think it still is, as a matter of fact. They evaluated me, and yes, I was a candidate. And then they gave me a pager and said, wait. So I waited, and eventually they did call me. On December 16th, 1984, they called me, and I had my very first liver transplant. And everything went very well, and it was a big deal because at the time, obviously, transplantation was new. The methods weren't, or I should say, perhaps the procedure was way more involved. So, therefore, anesthesia stayed with me for 2 weeks. The jitters, shaking, very very difficult to get over. But slowly but surely, I did get healthy, obviously, and I was very, very happy, and I moved to Los Angeles. I was living in Munich, Germany. I moved to Los Angeles because I wanted to be in the States, somewhere not exactly close to the doctors, but I could get there faster than if I lived in Europe. So I moved to Los Angeles, and other transplant centers were gearing up. So there was some doctors that I had met in Pittsburgh were starting up programs in Los Angeles and other parts of the country. So I felt more comfortable. And also, I had never lived in the States, and it was an opportunity for me. I'm very fortunate, I have to say, because I was my boyfriend at the time, the gentleman I was living with, who was 30 years my senior, was quite wealthy. So I have to say, there was a benefit to being able to choose. So I didn't have to stay in Germany. I would be able to live comfortably in LA thanks to my ex-boyfriend. At this point, he was already my ex-boyfriend, who had vowed to support me as long as I needed it. And I cannot say how thankful I am for that. He was a wonderful man and kept his word. So I moved into the Chateau Marmont Hotel, a very famous hotel here in LA. And then I eventually fell in love and married my first husband. And we moved into a condo here in Los Angeles. And that's when I had my children, which I just told the story of how they
right.
were conceived. Which
right.
Was, yeah.
Well, obviously, mm-hmm. the story goes on because you had two more liver transplants. We'll let the readers find out all the
yes.
details and all the twists and turns of that. But I love this statement. You say, don't allow chronic disease to take over your life. Now, how did you accomplish that?
Well, as anyone knows who has a chronic disease, you are constantly vigilant. You have to be. It's the nature of the beast. Chronic disease is there with you, and it will take over your mind if you let it. And I think this, again, exercise, eating healthy foods, getting interested in other things than what is going on with you is so important. It's important to be out in the world. It's important to be knowledgeable about your situation, but about so many other things. It's important to educate yourself, not only about your disease, but also about other things. You have to be interested. You have to stay interested in the world. I think it's so important to keep your mind away from what is happening with your own body and yourself.
Well, you also say in conjunction with that, don't wait for others to make you feel better. This is personal responsibility.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And I mean, this was a hard lesson for me to learn because I became ill very young and I didn't know any of these things, obviously. I learned them. I learned them through trial and error and through basically having other people make me feel whole. It was, I mean, they didn't. Obviously not. What I'm saying is I went through that experience of hoping, of latching onto people and hoping that being with them or whatever, having them close to me would make me feel better. And it doesn't. You have to make yourself feel better. You have to do things that will fulfill your soul, fulfill you physically. And again, I cannot stress enough, exercise. I don't care if it's just, you know, walking around the block daily, but there has to be something, you know. In my case, I'm a little bit, I overdo it. I'm a huge, I push myself because that's what I like for me. For me, it was always, I'm always in competition with myself physically, but that's not everybody. Having said that, others can find ways to still be active. Being active is so incredibly important. So,
and another point yeah. that you feel very passionate about, it seems, it's important for everyone to consider becoming an organ donor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In this day and age, it is so easy. You can do it through Facebook, even on the internet nowadays, I hear. It is important that everybody become an organ donor. Every person, there's so much you can give. If it's just your retina, I mean, whatever it is, when you pass, not everybody is an organ donor. Let's say that there are people obviously like me, and if you're ill, obviously you're not an organ donor. But if you're a healthy person, also I have to say this because there's some misconception about organ donation. There are two different types. A cadaveric donor is someone who has, let's say, passed very quickly. You cannot have just died of natural causes and then become an organ donor because your organs die with you. So it's not going to happen. But nowadays, they do have a situation whereby if you are dying, you can say you want to become an organ donor, because within the first hours of your death, you can still harvest organs, meaning you can still be gracious and donate your organs to someone. You cannot do it if you've been dead, obviously. You cannot do it if you... they have ways today that if you die and you so choose prior to your death and you have so stipulated, you can become an organ donor. But not if you die and you haven't made any arrangements, because obviously your organs die with you. On the other hand, people who have brain dead, you can't know this in advance, obviously. But if you die in such a situation, for instance, the ski accident, which was one of my cases, the young man died in the ski accident, then he was brain dead, his organs were still functioning. That was obviously viable organs, because his body was still pumping blood and so on. He just was never ever going to wake up again. And those are the ones that we mostly use. I mean, we must face it that today there's 115,000 people who are waiting for some sort of donor organ here in the United States. And I don't know, it's kidney, it's liver, it's retina, it's heart, whatever. But that's a lot of people. And 5,000 will die just waiting, because they won't get it within that year. So, yes, it's important for everybody to become an organ donor. And also, that person never knows if he might need one day. So, yes, I do think it's very important.
Gloria, we have just about a minute left. I wanted you to make one comment about this incredible bike ride, you and your oldest son, 545 miles from San Francisco to L.A. for a worthy cause. Tell us about how that made you feel.
Oh, yes, I am absolutely, this is a big achievement for me, because this was after 7 months after the third liver transplant. I had always wanted to participate.
The title of the book, Four Livers and No Funeral, Living with a Deadly Disease and Beating the Odds. The author is Gloria Edel. Gloria, tell us how to get your book.
My book is available on Balboa Press, obviously. I think it's also on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, but mainly Balboa Press. And you can get it there.
Thank you so much, Gloria, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Okay, thank you for having me.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing. And we'll be right back after these messages. Want to be challenged in a powerful way to leap beyond what you think is possible? Then join us Mondays for the Leah Jansen Show. Every Monday at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com with Leah Jansen. Listen live as life coach Leah uses her coaching skills to give you the tools you need to take action and create momentum. You are encouraged to call in and share your greatest fears, challenges, and obstacles. And then listen as Leah obliterates those barriers to success. For more on Leah and the show, check out her website, leahjansen.com. That's Leah, LEAHJANTZEN.com. Spend 1 hour with Leah, and you'll be captivated by her energy, enthusiasm, and magnetism. You'll quickly become addicted to her positive attitude and make-it-happen mentality. Ready for a life-changing, mood-altering show? Then get ready for Leah Jansen. And listen live to The Leah Jansen Show every Monday morning at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com.
People think I've made it. I'm popular. I seem happy all the time. I have great clothes and I'm involved in everything. But I have questions, doubts, and fears, just like every other teenager. That's why I'm glad for Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 central on TogiNet.com.
The choices we have to make that can alter the course of our lives. Life is too much pressure if we try to go it alone. I tune in to Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell every week to get reminded that I'm not alone. Nicole Odell is an expert on what happens in the lives of teenagers. Join her as she deals with topics like peer pressure, purity, drugs, alcohol, and many other things that might come up along the way. She writes books and speaks to people all over the place, but she says her favorite moments are when she can pull up a chair and chat with teens about what's important to us.
For more information on Nicole and her books, go to NicoleOdell.com. Then join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 central on TogiNet.com.
Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Healer Evolving. And the author is Sui Irvine. And Sui joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. This interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Sui.
Hi.
Well, this is a story, as the title says, it's evolving. I guess even at this moment in time, some things, new things continually are happening because of this spiritual journey you're on. But let me read just a short description of your book that you've written. You say, Healer Evolving is a story of love, courage, and breakthroughs. A woman's search for alternative therapies for her son becomes a spiritual journey. So that's what happened here. You were trying to find something to help your son, and it became much more than that. So give us some of those details, Sui.
Well, as a mother, I was very persistent in looking for things that would help my son, who had a diagnosis of cerebral palsy and severe asthma. And my search started in Western medicine, went to the outskirts, and then made the leap to Chinese herbs and acupuncture with quite a bit of success. And after those milestones were reached, I continued on my own for finding ways to fine-tune the healing that already manifested.
Well, and your book is very unique. It's written in a style that is, a little like poetry because it can be brief, but then, of course, there are some expanded descriptions of what you're experiencing. And it, what you say, it's done in a style that is refreshingly, and you use the word spare. Now, help us understand what you mean by that.
Well, I tell the story in a very succinct manner. And because of many of the things that I wrote about were intensely emotional for me, I wanted to have a lot of white space on the page so that the reader could take it in.
Well, very good. Well, why don't you, to begin with, and we're going to talk more about some of other things that are messages, themes in your book, but why don't you give us an example of this?
Okay, this is a piece called Glimpses. The charismatic speaker says, this approach is for the parents who go home and cannot not do the program. We hide to encourage 4-year-old Chad to crawl and find us. Bruce crouches on the stove. Gray-haired Ruth kneels behind the large bag of dog food under the chopping block. I stand in the coat closet. Gino and Sally come in the front door. Sally laughingly exclaims, you never know what you'll find when you walk in here anymore. Irene says, the track is boring. Put stickers on the floor. Give him something fun to look at. Daryl says, we're not just doing this for Chad. We're doing this for you and Sui. One of Bruce's colleagues says, it looks like the computer is going to be very busy this weekend. Bruce says, that's not the computer schedule. That's my wife's patterning schedule. I slap Chad on the butt on the patterning table. Rosemarie stops coming. Pauline arrives. I show her how to pattern. I say we need 3 people to put you Chad through the motions of a perfect crawl. We must have a no-show. My phone is not working. I'll be right back. I knock on doors. At the third house, someone is home. I return, say to Pauline, Harriet will be here in 5 minutes. I say, it's getting to me, Sally. She says, let's make a list of what would make it workable. Then we'll make that happen. While patterning Chad, Marilyn says, everything was going wrong this morning. I kept telling myself, when I get to Suey's, I'll tell her about it, and everything will be all right. Lou comes to the patterning meeting. Afterwards, he says, I want to be involved. Bruce sleeps in. He pours coffee wearing his green boxer shorts and a white undershirt. Anita walks into the kitchen for the 8:30 patterning session. She looks him square in the eye, says, I'm supposed to be here. You're not. I show Charlene how to respiratory pattern. She says, this could build up our boobs. Imagine all the mountain ladies with well-developed busts. People will think it's the water. Diana says, Eric doesn't like to be around Chad. He says Chad's a spoiled brat, and he is. Bruce is late for work. He enters the dining room in his three-piece brown wool suit, where Sally, Charlene, and I are patterning Chad. We each wish him a good day as we kiss him goodbye. I scream, I can't stand it anymore. Why don't you get yourself a real woman? Bruce yells, I have myself a real woman. Richard says, you're bringing the neighborhood together. Everyone has something in common. I say, Bruce, we have something to show you. 9-year-old Chad walks on his toes through the living room, through the kitchen, through the dining room, over 100 steps without falling. For the first time, Bruce sees his son walk. He says, it's unbelievable. Garth says, I heard about Chad. That's the best news I've heard in a long time. He made the quantum leap. At the Thank the Patterners party, Kathy says, I never thought I'd see the day Chad would walk. Noreen says, I knew it would happen. Linda says, you did what you said you were going to do. You got him walking. Now you're sending him to school. Sherry says, it's the most rewarding thing I've ever been a part of. Elaine writes on the card with the helium-filled balloons, we've never been so high.
Well, that took me a lot of places. I could see everything. That was remarkably well done. I mean, it's because it's you created so many images, even though it was fast-paced with everything changing, but that is very interesting. That's a unique style.
Yeah, a lot of dialogue and scenes.
Yes, yes. And just very vivid images.
Thank you.
Very vivid images. You know, I loved what you said. As your husband stood there in his underwear, you're not supposed to be here. I could just see her doing that.
We did have great laughs from that.
But, you know, and then, of course, the culmination of your son walking for the first time. I mean, I could, you know, we have a little bit of a understanding of cerebral palsy. We know how crippling it is. And here he is in his own style, I'm sure, walking for the first time.
Yes, yes.
Now, that was a rather lengthy one. Now, some of yours, I've been perusing your book, are very short.
Correct.
Give us an example of something, you know, a couple of them that are just, you know, some thoughts. It looks like you, or again, I guess they're all experiences, though, aren't they?
Yes. I've got one that's a little over a page long.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. On manifestation, Julio and I walked to the end of Avila Beach, where the swallows have built mud nests on the rock face. Into the waves, I cry out the things I am grateful for. A wave rolls a cold can of beer to Julio's feet. He yells, "Look at this." Picks it up, opens it, takes a swig. I laugh, yell back, "Julio, this feels really good to shout to the waves all I am thankful for. Try it." He faces the waves, cries out, "Poseidon, bring me more beer." 3 days later, he says to me, "You'll never guess what I found in the trash. A six-pack of beer."
You,
I guess you could, go you ahead. Could say Poseidon delivers.
Yes. I want to read a statement by one of your reviewers, an author of Wheels of Light, Reverend Rosalind, and how do you pronounce her last name?
Yeah, it's Rosalind Breyer.
Rosalind, okay. Well, she said this, "The energy of Sui's journey healed her. By sharing it, she allows readers to use the same energy to heal themselves." Now, give us more on that this process, this participation, if you will.
Okay. When I wrote, I tried to put the reader into the situations I was in and let them have their own experience. And from what others tell me, that this allows the reader, by reading the book, they become more compassionate to others as well as themselves.
Hmm. Interesting.
That would be a real healing.
Yes.
Well, to be compassionate to yourself.
Well, exactly. So many of us don't forgive ourselves, right?
Right, exactly.
You make some statements about some key messages in your book. There is a gift in every wound. Help us understand.
Okay. We had the dramatic situation of Chad's physical problems and a lot of hospitalizations. And the gift in that for me is that we had a wonderful family. His dad and I were just smitten with Chad. We had fabulous friends and wonderful community support. Also, a gift for me out of that, it allowed me to get in touch with my path as a healer that I had no idea of.
So in this process of healing ourselves, interacting with your book, you also say, trust your instincts and act on them.
Okay, in my book, I model for the reader how to do that. I show in a number of instances how I trusted my upsetness, when things weren't comfortable in my body, I changed the direction I was going in.
You also asked this question, I will ask it, a question that is really posed to you. Do you think Healer Evolving is a must-read for parents?
I think it's a great read for parents because parents are always going to have problems with their kids. And by having the benefit of my experiences, which are very dramatic, and also, as I said, modeling for people to follow your instincts, I think it will give them the courage to follow theirs, even if the problems are quite subtle.
Well, we've just got enough time for, why don't you read one more short one, a page or less?
About celibacy. At Aptos Natural Foods, congestion occurs in the aisle between the cash registers. I bump butts with the cute employee. Wanting to excuse myself, I turn to the young man and out slips, "Thank you."
Well, that's real honest. Oh, my goodness.
Yes, yeah, my ladies' friends enjoy that one.
Well, give us a closing thought, Sui.
A closing thought. Well, I think that it's so important to trust our intuition. My book has plenty of things about the way I did things. But what's most important is for each mother, each person to do their way and to also fight hard for their joy.
Well, as someone put it, when you read this book, you will laugh and cry with Sui, and she hopes you have a good read because you're going to discover her passion for healing. So thank you so much, Sui, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing. Tell us how to get your book.
My book's available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and at Balboa Press. And you can go to any store and order it.
And we want to remind everyone that this interview has been brought to them by Balboa Press.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.